Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. It's Wednesday. That means the Dakota Political Junkies are with us. Today, we welcome John Hunter, publisher of the Madison Daily Leader, and Seth Tupper, reporter and columnist with the Rapid City Journal. John Hunter, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Thanks, Lori. Glad to be here.
And Seth, thanks for being here as well.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
We're going to start with Initiated Measure 22. It's one of the ballot questions on the November ballot. And John Hunter, explain this measure to me as if I don't understand it at all, because I don't understand it at all. So let's start there. Give us the basics.
I'm not very much ahead of you, Lori, on some of that. But nevertheless, it is intended to be a... It's an initiated measure to revise our state's campaign finance and lobbying laws. Probably the biggest pillar of that is to create a method to for taxpayers to pay for campaign finances. There's some ethics commission kind of stuff in there. So it's really, I'd call it kind of a complete overhaul of a lot of election kinds of stuff. The pillar I was talking about really is creating these credits in which people can decide how some of their state tax dollars are spent on these campaigns. So, in other words, the supporters of this are trying to remove, you know, all the money now comes from contributors, and they really want to shift that to away from contributors, where they're implying that there is corruption or conflicts of interest and so forth, and shift it to state government. And the opponents are quick to say, you know, let's not spend limited state resources on campaigns for political office, that the status quo is better. So I don't know if that helps, Lori, but there are a lot of parts to that.
Seth, what element of this is getting the most sort of buzz around? Is it the democracy credits portion or pillar, as we can call it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's to the chagrin of the supporters of the bill. You know, the opponents who have organized to try to defeat this initiated measure have really focused on this credits that people would get from state government to assign to candidates. It'd be $50 credits for each registered voter. They could assign them to candidates who agree to participate in the program, and it would be funded by an appropriation from state government. And you know, a lot of people have seen some of the materials already from the group opposed to this measure, and they have pictures of a mysterious hand coming in and stuffing money into a politician's pocket, for example, saying, you know, this measure is trying to take your state dollars and give it to politicians, and they're calling it a political slush fund, et cetera. So there's no question that the opponents have wanted to make that the focus. It's a very easy and understandable thing to latch onto and try to use as a reason to defeat the measure, and I think that's been the focus so far, and it's going to be up to the people who are for this measure to try to shift the focus to the broader measure and some of the other factors that they like about it.
So, speaking of the mysterious hand, who is against it and who is for it? Who are the groups that are sort of rallying on either side of this, John? Do you have a take on that?
Well, certainly, former Senate candidate Rick Weiland is a supporter of this and kind of the, in some ways, the public face of it. He has been out stopping in different communities and talking about three different measures that are on the ballot. This is one of them. And so, you know, he has said that he has experienced this kind of stuff firsthand in his runs for Congress. The opponents, I think, I mean, Larry Roden, I think, wrote the kind of a ballot explanation on why it should be defeated. So Larry Roden, kind of a prominent legislator, Republican legislator. So I think you'd probably generally say conservatives who don't want taxes to be spent on campaigns would be the opponents. But maybe Seth knows more about the organization of the opposition.
Yeah, Seth,
yeah, there's
go ahead.
You know, people who follow politics are familiar with the Koch brothers, who have this group called Americans for Prosperity, and they are against the measure, and we don't really know a whole lot yet about how much they're spending to oppose the measure in South Dakota, but they are against it. And you know, there, as we said, there's many things in the measure, and some of the provisions in the measure would reveal more about donations that are funneled through nonprofits in the way that the Koch brothers often do their donating and fundraising, and so they're against it, and they don't want that, greater transparency to take effect. And they say, you know, that greater transparency would have a chilling effect on certain political donations. They're against it, and of course they have a lot of resources to commit if they so choose.
Seth, isn't that the whole idea, a greater transparency that would have an effect on who's giving the money? Is that proponents would say?
Yeah, I mean, the measure is fighting exactly what the opponents are doing. So it's, you know, it's Rick Weiland ran, you know, for Senate as kind of an anti-big money candidate. And this is really, you know, in a lot of ways, and is an extension of that message. And what he would say, and I'm sure he is saying, and he's coincidentally going to be in Rapid City Friday campaigning, is that, you know, the opponents that have emerged to this measure and the money that they're spending is exactly why the measure is needed, is I'm sure what he would say.
So, John, my question here is, why do the Koch brothers, why does anybody outside the state of South Dakota, because I keep hearing this again and again about our ballot questions, who's funding it, where's the money coming from? We don't have the information we'd like to have to answer those questions, but why does anybody outside of South Dakota care what gets on our ballot? What are the implications of that, John?
Well, there are a bunch of them, and there's part of that's that question really relates to why South Dakota is part of these things, and that is a lot of these initiated measures and so forth are, they like to start, and when I say they, people who want this kind of effect nationally, like to start it in a small state. It's a more affordable way to get this done. Do you remember a few years ago there was a group from the Northeast that wanted to put in a part of our own laws here that would allow people accused of crimes to not only be able to argue their innocence or guilt to a crime, but instead the validity of the law itself. And it didn't come at all from South Dakota. It was from New Hampshire or Vermont or someplace. And so they, you know, bring those things here, try them out, and, you know, then they can maybe get some judgment for it. So being a small state and kind of being an affordable place to try things. Now, this Measure 22 has certainly many out-of-state supporters on both sides. Let's just acknowledge that. And this is not necessarily just a handful of people at coffee shops in South Dakota who are either for or against this. So this, in some senses, is a national concern. A lot of this spins out, too, of the kind of freedom of speech and the ability of corporations to donate to political campaigns. And so it is, in many senses, a national issue, not necessarily a South Dakota issue. And I'm confident that these kinds of things, depending on the success in South Dakota, that would be tried in other states. It may very well be on other ballots this November that I'm not aware of. So this is very much a national issue starting in South Dakota.
Seth, what do the proponents of this bill, Rick Weiland and others, there's certainly some conservatives who are making the circuit as well. I think some are down at the Argus Leader today. They'll be here on SDBB later on for a recorded conversation. What do they want to be focusing on? If they don't want us to be sort of distracted, I mean, certainly we want to talk about democracy credits, but they don't want that to be the sole focus. What do they want that main push to be? How do they want us to think about it?
Well, I think they probably rather shift the focus to corruption and things like that. I mean, you know, this measure grew partly out of some of the scandals we've had here in recent years with the EB-5 immigrant investor scandal that we had, with the scandal that we had in Platt with Mid-Central Educational Cooperative and people allegedly, stealing money that came from federal grants through state government. And, you know, part of this bill is aimed at that as well, and limiting influence on politicians and establishing an ethics commission. And I would guess that as they try to fight back on this narrative about using taxpayer dollars to fund campaigns, I would guess that they'll try to say, well, that's part of it, but there are many other parts to the measure that aim to limit and diminish government corruption.
John, is this not a political party issue if we have Democrats like Rick Wyland and then some conservative thought leaders weighing in on the same thing? Does it defy party boundaries?
Oh, that's an excellent question, Lori. I think it tends to, these things tend to go to parties anyway, even if they aren't, don't start as such. But certainly Rick is a party person, and so then people will associate that with him. And conservatives, Koch brothers, are certainly on the Republican kind of side, so people will be labeled with that. I don't think this is necessarily such, but I think it will be labeled as it. I want to go back once quickly to Seth's comment on the credits and the corruption and that kind of thing. Part of the supporters' idea is that corruption in South Dakota, especially those two things, cost South Dakota money, cost South Dakota government money, and to fight these. And if we had less corruption, we'd have more money to do other things. And they're saying this, these democracy credits. And again, that, I think there will be many South Dakotans who will oppose that, but we'll say, look, if you know this kind of thing can save a lot of money, is not necessarily spend it. And voters will be able to make their own choice on that kind of concept.
They have a lot of many choices to make.
Indeed.
The bottom of the ballot is quite interesting this year. And John Hunter, I think you said South Dakota is an affordable place to try things. So we're going to add that to our list of words of wisdom about the state political climate. We're also affordable to try out new things. Seth, let's go on and talk about a piece that you had in the Rapid City Journal on Sunday. It's a really comprehensive look at something that maybe people haven't considered, which is the safety regulations on carnival rides. Give us an overview of this piece that you wrote.
Yeah, it started as just, when the Central States Fair was here in town, we wanted to look at amusement ride safety because of there have been so many highly publicized accidents this past summer in the country, especially the incredibly tragic story about the young boy who was decapitated on a water slide. And so we looked into that, and I started looking at what laws do we have, and found out that most of them were passed a couple of years ago as a result of some riders being stuck on a ride in Syston. And that bill was described and was put forward as a bill to make rides safer. But as I started researching it, how the bill was adopted and who was for it and what it actually said, the legislation really didn't require carnival operators to do much of anything they weren't already doing. It exempted amusement parks, permanently fixed parks, whose rides don't travel around. It exempted them from inspections. And it also implemented this rather large new section of the law that puts regulations on riders and says what they can't do and says if they violate any of these rules, it can be used against them in court. And so I thought, well, if this is supposed to be a bill to improve the safety of rides, it doesn't really read that way. And that became less surprising when you consider one of the bill's two sponsors was Al Novstrup, a lawmaker from Watertown who owns amusement parks. And so that was kind of the gist of the piece, was examining how did this come about, how did it go from an effort to improve the safety of rides to really in the end it imposed more words of new regulations on riders than on the people who operate the rides. So it was kind of a fascinating piece, and when the bill passed it didn't get a lot of attention because people weren't paying nearly as much attention to ride safety as they are now in light of all the serious accidents that we've had this summer. But it was certainly interesting to learn a lot more about it.
So, John, we're back to talking about ethics. As far as a business owner who's in the state house, kind of addressing an issue that affects his bottom line, certainly.
Yes, and that takes place all through politics at local, state. I mean, we elect farmers to the legislature, and they are on agriculture committees and so forth, and there's not much wrong with that, and I think most people would agree, as long as it's fully disclosed, and I think it was, I mean, everyone, I think, in the legislature, at least at that time, I don't remember it actually much happening. I don't know if Seth does. This kind of missed the headlines a little bit in 2014, but I think everyone knew that Al was involved with that, and he brought in his people in trade associations that he belonged to and so forth to assist with that. So as far as disclosure and openness, I think it probably satisfied that. But those things happen all the time. I mean, there are legislators who represent, there are doctors in the legislature, and they vote on medical bills. And so in some cases, the people in the industry are good at that, and other times it could be self-serving. So and I think in most cases, the ethics demand that those things are fully disclosed and everyone knows those relationships.
Seth, what happens next as far as the legislation stands? And those are the rules that we have right now, correct?
And well, nothing will happen unless somebody proposes a bill to further modify the rules. Part of the story, one of the only legislators at the time who expressed any reservations about any of this was Scott Parsley, a Democrat from Madison. And if he wins re-election, it's potential, I suppose, that he could bring something. But at the time, he expressed some reservations and said, gee, it seems like we're putting more of the onus on riders here than we are on ride operators and carnival companies. And nevertheless, he voted for the bill. He said he felt that some regulation was better than none, which previously we had no requirements for any inspections, really anything at all. Hmm. And so he did vote for it. But, yeah, it would be incumbent on any legislators who would want to do something at this point to bring a bill. And I would say, incidentally, Al Novstrom didn't necessarily do anything wrong. I mean, he was elected and everybody knew he owned amusement parks and he used his influence he exerted his influence on this bill. But one of the things I questioned during the reporting was, where was everybody else? Nobody ever brought it up that I heard listening to all the recordings of hearings on this bill. Nobody ever said, maybe it's not the greatest idea to let a guy who owns amusement parks be the one who primarily writes regulations on his own business. There were no certified ride inspectors brought in to testify. There were no, safety advocates, safety organizations. It was really, a lot of just listening to Al Novstrom, and that was it. And so, that was my question, was where was everybody else?
You can read that piece in its entirety at rapidcityjournal.com. That came out in the newspaper on Sunday. Let's shift a little bit and talk about the United Nations, which isn't something we usually get to expand our scope to, but Dave Archambault II, who is the chair of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, went to the United Nations, stood in front of the Human Rights Council, I believe it's called, and made his case for the tribe. John, did you get to follow that all, or see what that speech was?
Well, I'm very impressed that he was able to speak in Geneva on that particular topic. There is that council, the Human Rights Council, that talks about these kinds of things, especially with kind of treaties and all sorts of things. So it's really notable that someone from South Dakota, an issue like ours, goes before that committee. It's pretty extraordinary, and so I think that will gain probably the attention that he was looking for, and that there will be at least a visit or some sort of attention that will come to this by speaking about this topic. And I think the protest and the notability of that opposition to the Dakota Access Pipeline is still on its way up. It's grown from something small to something medium, and I think it's going to get only bigger now.
Hmm. Seth, your thoughts on Dakota Access Pipeline protests and sort of the things you've been hearing from folks at West River even?
Well, I think a lot of people at West River, as it continues, are their views are evolving, and they're still trying to figure out exactly what to make of it. And I think what one of the really interesting things is that the pipeline, as I understand it, is about halfway built. So, you know, it's, I think we're all just kind of on pins and needles just to find out, you know, what exactly is going to occur, and will the legal challenges have been mounted by some of the tribal interests, you know, thwart this project? And if it does, where do we go from there? If they're able to win this battle, the tribal interests, is this going to be a shifting point in you know, our dependence on crude oil, and will it you know, propel us toward cleaner energy or anything, or will this just be kind of a one-time flash in the pan controversy that, however it turns out, just goes away?
Let's finish up with Seth Representative Dan Dryden, who passed away recently but is still on the ballot. Give us an update as far as what that might look like going forward to November 8th.
Yeah, he was running for election to the House, and of course in South Dakota, each district has two House seats, and here in his district, which is kind of the western part of Rapid City, there was he, another Republican, and a Democrat are on the ballot, with the top two finishers winning the seat. So it's possible that he could still finish number one or two, despite being deceased, and you know, win the election. And but the kicker is that Governor Dugard has said that he very soon will appoint somebody to fill the remainder of Dan Dryden's existing term, which, you know, stretches from now to early January. So essentially, if people vote for Dan Dryden, they're voting for whomever the governor appoints to fill that seat, and then the governor would reappoint that person to replace Dryden. If you're following all that, it's getting
My question is, will they know who they're voting for, or will they be voting for Governor Dugard's appointment but not knowing who that is?
Some will, you know, but I think it's without question a lot of people won't. I mean, obviously, as we've noted already, there's 10 you know, ballot questions on the ballot. There's some other issues, you know, on the ballot as well, and other races, and not everybody obviously is going to realize that you know, one of the people on the ballot is deceased. And they may just vote, if they're Republican, they may just vote for the Republican. Some people may realize that he is deceased and vote because they want a Republican to hold the office, and they know that they're voting for Governor Dugard's appointee. But you know, the interesting thing will be, you know, if a deceased person wins an election, it's obviously kind of a rarity, and I'm not sure in the history of the legislature if that has happened before. I'm trying to look into that a little bit, actually, but it would be obviously a rarity.
Seth Tupper is with the Rapid City Journal. Seth, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And John Hunter, any final words on, you know, we could talk for another 15 minutes, probably, couldn't we? We should just say thank you, John Hunter.
We look forward to the next Political Junkies.
All right, thanks. We'll see you then.